You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, 9 days until kickoff. Will France's current crisis be resolved, or are we going to be watching Euro 2016 through clouds of tear gas? My guests, Daniela Peled and Jonathan Fenby, will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the latest polls ahead of the UK's EU referendum. Momentum for leaving appears to be gathering. Donald Trump's renewal of hostilities with America's media, and his endorsement by North Korea's, and Switzerland amazes the world with its new railway tunnel and baffles the planet with the opening ceremony. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Managing Editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, and Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post, now Managing Director of the China team at Trusted Sources, also author of The History of Modern France, which is just out in updated paperback, which is handy because we're starting in France, which is currently enjoying the showdown between government and trades unions, which has become a traditional part of the build-up to any major sporting tournament, at least in countries where trades unions are permitted. With 9 days to go before France kicks off against Romania at the Stade de France to begin Euro 2016, the government has made some concessions, but strikes are ongoing, on top of which the US State Department have reiterated their travel alert for Europe, citing concerns about terrorism. Jonathan, first of all, on the scale of French crises, and obviously your updated book runs through several, on a scale of a relatively quiet week by French standards to 1968, where does this rank, do you think?
It's not up there with 1968 at the moment. It's not as big. The protests, the strikes are nothing like the general strike that one had in 68. But on the other hand, this is the latest of a whole series of protests, strikes against François Hollande, the president, who is running for re-election in a year's time. And the longer this process goes on and the longer his inability to govern it shows itself, the more trouble France is in.
I mean, Daniela, is there something ritualistic about this? I mean, 4 years ago, before the Olympic Games here in London, the tube drivers went on strike or threatened to, as did various others. It's a thing that always happens, isn't it?
I think that's the whole point about strikes, is the maximum leverage
indeed
possible.
Indeed so.
But I'm not sure that in France, I'm going to be terribly stereotypical here, but I'm not sure in France they need the excuse of a massive sports game to do this. I went to France for the bank holiday, and before I left, so many people warned me about the scenes of devastation and sort of apocalypse that I was going to meet in the channel, and that we had to fill up the car like to the brim and lemonade bottles full of petrol. Disappointingly,
sorry, was that to refuel the car or throw it?
Well, multi-purpose. To my great disappointment, all was normal, was quiet, even, dare I say it, quite efficient. But this kind of this sort of strike activity does feed into this enormous stereotype we have on this side of the channel about the French. I don't think this is doing the pro-Remain camp very much good. I mean, it doesn't, you know, to see our nearest European neighbours throwing such a... I mean, I don't mean to be unkind to the workers of France, but it does seem to be somewhat of a strop, because the French economy is not in the most wonderful state, and I'm not an economist or an expert on France, I'm sure Jonathan can speak to this much more detail, but it seems to me that it's more about class war at the moment than anything else. It's a political battle rather than looking sensibly at the chance of any kind of reform which might make the labour market more accessible, as well as taking away some privileges to the labour force.
I mean, the first time I was ever tear gassed was in Paris, certainly. I mean, it's kind of, You haven't really done Paris until that's happened to you at least once, have you?
Well, I can beat you. The first time I was tear gassed was in Saigon in 1966. So that was before any of you were born.
You were literally being tear gassed before any of us were born.
Yeah, thrown by Buddhist monks. I definitely went there. The tear gas is there and so on. But what this is the assertion, which goes back, and in my book I go through all this over the centuries, goes back to the revolution, which is the citizen's right to take action, direct action, in the streets, regardless of what the political process has thrown up here. And you have the government, the Valls government and the Hollande administration, trying to reform the labour laws in a way which would make it easier to fire people, but that would encourage employers, and I do believe this, to hire people. I know plenty of small French companies which won't hire anyone when times are good for fear that they won't be able to lay them off if things are less good and so on. And the cost of employment is, of course, very high with the subsidiary payments from companies and from employers in France. So the government wants to ease up the labour market. And, of course, this is very easy for the left to denounce as a boss's charter. This is playing into the hands of evil multinationals and so on and so on. But what you've actually got is a rather strange alliance here between young people, students, who make up a lot of the demonstrators at the moment and who probably aren't going to get a job. 80% of first-time employees in France are on one-month contracts at the moment because of the fear of being saddled with an overlarged labour force. And the unity of that with the big trade unions, which are basically out there to keep the vested interests. So you've got a strange kind of, you know, student conservative with a small C working class movement there, which doesn't do anyone any good. Double-digit unemployment, 25% among young people, and so on.
Daniela, this latest reiteration from the US State Department warning against visiting continental Europe, citing concerns about terrorism, is there any reason to take that especially seriously? Because there's no way I can say this without sounding glib, but it's definitely not intended as such. Statistically, your chances of getting shot while at school or work in the United States are exponentially vaster than being caught up in a terrorist incident in Europe.
Well, of course, if you look at it in any statistical fashion, the risk of terrorism is minimal. I don't quite see what the US are doing here, apart from just, you know, covering their backs. I mean, when they urge extra vigilance, I mean, are American tourists supposed to be on the lookout for people with suspicious looking rucksacks? And is that supposed to thwart a mega terror attack? Again, I don't want to be glib, but somebody who lives in London, fewer tourists might make this summer a little bit more enjoyable. I don't think anyone, I don't think it will make any difference, and I don't see that it will achieve anything at all.
Hey, what do you think, Jonathan? I mean, I couldn't agree more with what Daniela's just said. I never understand the point of these warnings from the point of view of governments, because, you know, as Daniela said, what are people supposed to do with this information?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think it's more what she said. Daniela said it's governments. They've come into possession of some piece of information which might mean something, and they're anxious to cover their backs, because if they hadn't issued a warning and something did happen, you'd get stories coming out in the media a little while later saying, oh, they failed to warn people. But, you know, are you meant to look under every bus seat? Are you meant to look in all the dustbins? It's a meaningless kind of warning, I think.
Final thought from you on the situation in France, Jonathan. It is, as I was saying, 9 days until kickoff at Start de France. Surely one way or another, a solution will be found before then, because presumably neither government nor the unions wish to be blamed for being the ones who screwed up the football.
They should find a solution, but I'm not sure. I don't think they will, because, in fact, the government has already given several concessions which weren't enough to head off the current protests, and they either have to give up the labour law completely or not. And Hollande particularly has said, I'm going to stick with this one. He's already widely depicted as a jelly or a blancmange without any real strength of conviction. If he did this, his credibility for the presidential election next year, where his standing in the poll is only around 15% as it is, would drop right out of the bottom, and he wants to get a second term if he can.
Okay, well, let's move along, because meanwhile here in the UK, if the most recent polls are to be believed, Euro 2016 may be among the last times that English football fans are able to cross the channel without a visa. This will doubtless come as something of a relief to continental cafe proprietors and riot policemen, but it will signal a radical redrawing of Britain's relationship to the EU, although nobody seems too clear about what the precise consequences would look like. Daniela, online and phone polls are now showing a 52-48 lead for Leave. Is this just the natural charm of Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, Nigel Farage and Ian Botham having its inevitable effect?
Don't forget George Galloway.
And George Galloway.
Yeah, absolutely. If the polls would be to be believed, I think probably not. I mean, this is one poll taken over a bank holiday weekend, which according to pollsters is some sort of special case, maybe because all sensible people are in the pub or in the garden. It doesn't. I don't think it shows a massive reversal. But I think this is, I'm bracing myself for the next less than a month. I mean,
it's 3 weeks tomorrow.
Right. OK, well, 3 weeks tomorrow.
All over.
Yeah. I feel pretty apocalyptic about it. I mean, it could nearly be all over for everyone. I don't think these polls are really showing us much one way or another. I mean, if we look at it, if we take the sort of length of polls, they still remain neck and neck, with perhaps a slightly in favour of remaining. And all this excitement over this one poll that has shown a drift towards the other side is sort of symptomatic of the level of debate that has been so far, where I've been searching for convincing arguments to remain for the sceptics in my own family and failing to find them. And I've been wanting to read a convincing argument for the other side. I mean, I hold my hands up. I'm a definite remainer. But I would like to hear something convincing and reasonable and non-vitriolic from somebody holding an opposite view for me. And it's been very, very, very thin on the ground.
The debate has been largely extremely silly, hasn't it, Jonathan?
It has indeed. It has plumbed some kind of depths a lot of the time. And the trouble is that the Remain camp, and I too am a Remainer, I'm sorry, we should have an argument here, but we're going to find it difficult to have a row over this one. The Remain camp has been, I think, quite diligent in its arguments, very straightforward, well-reasoned, but pretty boring in the end. And the other side have become more and more silly as the weeks and months have gone on. So there's my propaganda side and so on. And it's almost a spectacle now, I think, from the Leave camp. And the most interesting thing, in a sense, of course it's important what the outcome of this, has been the effect on the Conservative Party and the way that we've now got a split governing party in a one-party state, which is not a very healthy state of affairs.
I'm not sure I agree with you there. I mean, I'm on the side of the Remain camp, but I think there's been some seriously mistaken messaging, which is to position people in favour of Brexit as basically provincial racists, stuck in some sort of 1950s provincial British ideal. I mean, both sides have been guilty of this kind of just argument by ridiculing the other side.
I mean, there is a logical flaw there, whereas it's probably reasonable to assume that while all provincial racists are in favour of leaving, not all the people in favour of leaving are provincial racists.
Right, exactly. And I think the Remain camp has to shoulder some of the blame about the level of debate, because that has been far too easy a target. And I'm not just saying this because members of my own family, as I said, are leaning towards Brexit.
Is there a thing, though, Daniela, that the Remain camp is kind of caught by the bind that a lot of some of the Leave vote might be part of that just inchoate anti-establishment feeling at large everywhere, and the more the political and business and media establishment say remaining is the sensible thing, the more people are going to be hostile to the idea?
I think that's definitely a danger, but I think that's the kind of bluster that people come up with before an actual event. And when it's time to make a decision, and people generally naturally prefer stability over change, but I'm not sure that the anti-establishment aspect of voting out is the one that would swing it.
Jonathan, what we are starting to see now from the Leave campaign as we get into the last 3 weeks is a more or a less apologetic, I guess you could say, deployment of the immigration card. Mm-hmm. isn't this what it's basically always been about all along?
Yes. I mean, that's the glue that holds that side of the argument together. And, of course, as you can see, you know, they will jump on any kind of immigration scare that there is. But, of course, at the same time, the more it comes down to that, to a one-issue referendum and so on, the more the danger for the Leave side that people who are not that worried about immigration, but who may not particularly like, you know, Brussels or the EU or any other element of belonging to the EU, they may say, oh, well, I don't want to be associated with an anti-immigrant party, which a lot of people will hold up as being racist.
I mean, I have a vested interest here, obviously, speaking as somebody who has come over here and presented all your radio programmes. And
you'll be the first to go, yeah. I can tell you.
Stolen all our puns.
Yeah, yes. I've done all of those things. I mean, Daniela, again, is there a way that the Remain camp can actually engage with the immigration argument? Is there a way in which you can actually, in the current climate, say, I'm basically in favour of immigration, I'm quite relaxed about free movement of EU citizens, or is that just electoral suicide at the moment?
Honza, are you actually calling for people to have an intelligent and reasoned argument about immigration?
I am.
Well, okay.
I know, it's crazy.
We'll be talking about refugees like that next. It's very unlikely. I don't think that it's impossible. I think it's very difficult to get the tone right. That's the problem. It's very difficult to get the tone right between sort of shrillness on either end of the argument, and then the problem about the establishment making a case for this, then you have the idea of the metropolitan elite saying, oh, well, come on, you should all do this. This is fine. You know, just accept what we're going to say, because people are just going to come over and take your jobs. But you've got to believe us when we say we know what's good for you. It doesn't work very well. It's very, very difficult. But I think we should still try.
Jonathan, the horror, I think, to me, the nightmare scenario, the thing that could almost make me wake screaming in the night is, what if Remain wins, but only just? So I guess the question I'm asking is, if Remain wins, and the betting markets haven't budged, by the way, in the face of these polls at all, they still see it's still odds on for a Remain win, for whatever that may be worth. How much does Remain need to win by so we don't have to do this again?
They need at least a 55-45, preferably a 60-40 majority there. And also you've got the whole, what I referred to a moment ago, you've got the whole question of David Cameron's leadership of the government and of the Conservative Party involved in this. And he needs a pretty strong number, because otherwise the Boris Johnsons and the Goves of this world will constitute, as it were, a shadow Conservative Party waiting to take over the leadership, and with the support of probably a majority of backbench members of Parliament and certainly of constituency parties. So Cameron himself is the person who actually needs this big number in order to be able to assert himself, rather than finding himself, you know, one remembers John Major in the 1990s, who was endlessly fighting against the bastards within his own, as he called them. That was a scoop we had at the Observer.
Wouldn't it have been brilliant if they had actually formed a separate political party called the Bastards?
We had a cartoon once suggesting that, indeed. They never got up to it. But, you know, Cameron doesn't want to find himself in that position, because he would then probably resign, go off to the countryside, and you'd have a bloody civil war between George Osborne on the one hand and the Johnson camp on the other. And with the Labour Party playing a minimal role in governance and government as an opposition, effective opposition at the moment, this could be a very nasty political situation indeed.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Daniela Pellard and Jonathan Fenby. Coming up next, Donald Trump may struggle for the endorsement of the New York Times and the Washington Post, but he has DPRK Today in the bag.
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page, large-format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniela Pellet and Jonathan Fenby. Donald Trump is a prescient presidential candidate and a wise politician. And not, just so we're clear on this, rough-talking, screwy and ignorant. Those are not my words. They are the words of Han Yong-mook, who is a staff fulminator at DPRK Today, an official outlet like there's any other kind of North Korea. The same editorial also took the time to describe Mr. Trump's opponent as thick-headed Hillary. Let's hear what Britain's former ambassador to North Korea had to say about this. This is John Everard speaking to us a bit earlier.
It is a response to Donald Trump's famous statement about a week, 10 days ago now, that he would be prepared to sit down and meet Kim Jong-un. You'll remember that straight after that statement, the North Korean ambassador to the United Nations said he thought this was just a foolish bit of electioneering, but that the final decision would be down to his leader, i.e. down to Kim Jong-un. People read that as a dismissal of Trump's invitation. In fact, in North Korean terms, that was close to a yes. And this editorial reinforced that. What North Korea is saying is that if the American people are wise enough to elect this prudential leader, as they call him, then effectively he and Kim Jong-un can sit down and do a deal.
John Everard there. Daniela, why would a newspaper overseen by a belligerent demagogue with weird hair have kind words for Donald Trump?
Why indeed? Why indeed? Well, again, we're sitting here, I'm trying to sort of unpack the logic of statements and of events in North Korea, which I'm not...
It's always fun, isn't it?
Well, it's always fun, and it's always impossible. I mean, what it made me think of is that about 6 months ago, Donald Trump was endorsed by another shiny-faced demagogue by the name, drumroll, of Vladimir Putin.
Indeed so.
Now, we seem to have forgotten that. Now...
Is a pattern emerging.
Yeah. No, like, who is going to be next? Who's going to be next? Will this affect Trump's ratings at home? No. Should it make us even more worried? Yes. I mean, the reason one imagines is that all these demagogues lining up to say, yes, I endorse Trump, is that Trump symbolises a complete shake-up of American foreign policy, of American policy in general, of a complete free-for-all, of a complete free-fall. So why wouldn't that benefit North Korea and Russia? Certainly would.
Jonathan, is there any possibility, and this is a question that often occurs to me when contemplating the doings of Pyongyang, is there any possibility at all that this is basically them having a bit of a chuckle?
Well, you can interpret an awful lot of what comes out of North Korea as being some kind of farcical satire. Unfortunately, it isn't. But if you read, if you read the memoirs of people associated with the regime who've got out, and their accounts of, you know, how life is lived at the top by the elite, it does have an absolutely surreal quality to it. And it's quite possible that, you know, somebody said, "Oh, that Trump, you know, as Daniela says, he can serve our interests. Let's have a bit of a go here and push him up." And, you know, and maybe it means Trump will get the North Korean vote in North Carolina or wherever it is. Who knows? You know, this could be the election changer, I tell you.
I mean, the thing is, as has been pointed out before, I mean, Barack Obama in 2008 said he would have no difficulty talking to North Korea. Is there actually any chance, realistically, of a president of the United States ever actually sitting down with the chairman of the Workers' Party of Korea?
Only if they agree to build Trump Towers all along the DMZ, I think.
Which would weirdly surprise me, not in the least. I mean, staying on, it's really easy to picture that, actually.
And staying, they can just call the DMZ. Well, you know, this is Trump.
But it is the thing. We are deviating from the point here slightly. Donald Trump's sensibilities in interior decor are not a million miles removed from those which tend to be favoured by your sort of omnipotent despot type.
What does this tell us about the future?
Nothing good, I suspect. But Daniela, we do also need to talk about Donald Trump's relationship with the American press. He gave a splendidly rancorous press conference at Trump Towers yesterday. In which he actually said, "I'm going to continue to attack the press. I find the press to be dishonest. I find the political press to be extremely dishonest." The thing is, this is working for him, isn't it?
Well, this is exactly the point. I mean, I find myself in a room with basically, which has three journalists in it. Obviously, we have a rather higher opinion of the media as bastions of free speech and protectors of democracy. But what Trump did does plug into a growing feeling on both extremes of politics, on the right and the left, as the mainstream media is some sort of conspiratorial enemy of the people.
Yes, the MSM, as
the
I believe
MSM,
it's now known.
The MSM, yes, the MSM, indeed. And so this is another very populist manoeuvre by him. We're all outraged and horrified. How dare he speak to the gentleman, gentlewoman of the press like that? But for a lot of people watching it will think, good on you, Trumpy.
And even more so, because, I mean, he, at that press conference and at others, I was watching several in the States over the last few weeks and so on, he calls out individual reporters too. So he's making this, this is very Trumpian, he's making this very personal there, the people. But then he can make up. I mean, as with, you know, the Fox, Megan on Fox, who he had this great public row with, and now, if you're to believe them, they're best friends again.
OK, well, we've got another solid 5 months of being able to discuss Donald Trump's media strategy, which is something worth staying alive for. But finally tonight, we should spare a thought for the Seikan Rail Tunnel, which links Hokkaido and Honshu, because as of today, it is merely the world's second longest and second deepest railway tunnel, following the official opening of the Gotthard Base Tunnel, rather, between the Swiss Alps. 20 years in the boring, the 57-kilometre tunnel is also fairly grim news for European truck hauliers, because a million lorries worth of goods will now go by train instead. The opening ceremony, which, if you haven't seen, dear listener, you really should look up, featured milk floats, some people dressed as birds, a woman carrying a sheep, and a chap dressed as an ibex. Daniela, the symbolism was not entirely clear to me.
No, I heard that it cost 8 million euros, so obviously 8 million euros well spent on the entertainment.
I don't know what an ibex costume costs. I wouldn't know where to start guessing.
The problem for me, really, and I have to approach this on a purely emotional level as a borderline claustrophobe. It is all about symbolism, the symbolism of tunnels. Not great. This is a very British thing. The idea, even going on the tunnel at the weekend, gave me a slight...
The third longest railway tunnel in the world.
Well. But the idea of people being free to drive through such tunnel did slightly give me heebie-jeebies. I was on the train with some European friends. They thought it made much more sense to have a tunnel under the channel than a train. The very thought makes me feel slightly ill.
Jonathan, China is planning to build one actually more than twice as long under the Bohai Strait between Dalian and Yantai. Is there actually a limit, though, do you think, to how long people can tolerate being underground in a train?
I think there very probably is. I don't know where it is. And so
probably there are commuters on the Northern Line who can...
I was going to say, yeah, maybe two stations is my limit. I take buses whenever possible. But actually China's planning, or there's talk of an even longer one between the east coast of the mainland of China and Taiwan, which would be about 80 miles or so. I don't know how that stacks up in your record book there. But
go close, I would think.
As it happens, I was in Taiwan last week, and there was jokes about this. Was, would you be afraid of, would it be cars going through? Would you be afraid of drivers, mainland drivers coming, da-da-da-da? And then somebody on Taiwanese said, no, what we would really be afraid of would be watching the exit to the tunnel in Taiwan. And who do we see coming out of there? Tanks of the People's Liberation Army. So
that would need to be a very wide tunnel.
It could be the invasion route.
Final thought on this, Danielle, and we will attempt optimism, because Merkel, Hollande and Renzi all turned up at the opening, where there was the chap dressed as the ibex and the milk floats. The Swiss are trying to make this about, you know, the continent. This is good news for all of us. This is bringing Europe together at a time of great division, etc., etc., etc. Are we buying that?
Are we buying what the Swiss say? Again, you're stoking the flames of the very, British, you know, this is what happens when we all just get along. No, I don't buy that.
Jonathan?
I don't know. This could be a great symbol for Brexit, couldn't it? There. Push them all down the tunnel.
Well, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Granina. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next at 1900. Daniel is back for The Entrepreneurs, and there's more on the day's main stories with The Daily at 2200. I will also be your host for that. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.